It's hard to know where to begin. You know, I've been reading so much about what is happening in Gaza, and the overall feeling I have is just one of horror and sadness. The scope of death and destruction is really unimaginable. And when world leaders are indifferent, or even worse in our case, in the United States case, the United States is complicit, mass murder on an unimaginable scale can take place. Especially when a population such as the Palestinians are dehumanized, and they are. It is much easier for world leaders and the media to be silent. The numbers are so shocking that it dehumanizes the suffering to just read the statistics. But human beings are not numbers. Every death, whether Israeli or Palestinian or a Thai worker who was killed by a Hamas rocket in Israel, every person has a story, has a history, and each one needs to be told. I was stunned a few days ago. I read about the death of 24-year-old Californian-born Israeli Sergeant Max Steinberg. Max Steinberg was my father's name. My name is Dory Steinberg. My first radio boss said, chop off the berg. It'll be sound better on radio. I said, okay, whatever you say. The funeral of soldier Max Steinberg was attended by 30,000 Israelis. 30,000. There are now anywhere 1,000 to 1,100 Gazans who have been counted as dead. There may be still more under rubble. Most are not able to have a funeral. There's no place to hide in Gaza. There's no safe place to hide. Civilians, other than outside this humanitarian ceasefire, are vulnerable to artillery fire, tank shells, being bombed from the air or sea at all times. On July 22nd, Gaza City, there's a Gaza City doctor, Dr. Mona Elfara. She is a contributor to Mecca for Peace, which is an organization based in Berkeley and has projects in Gaza, in the West Bank, and in Lebanon. They do amazing work, meccaforpeace.org, F-O-R-P-E-A-C-E, meccaforpeace.org. And quoting Dr. Mona Elfara, she says, 2 days ago, this was July 22nd, 2 days ago on my way to the Red Crescent Clinic and Hospital, I stopped in one of the shops and bought 6 bottles of water. There was a boy helping his father in the shop, and he carried the water to the car for me. He was so nice, about 11 years old. His name was Mohammed Amar, and we chatted, and he had a lovely smile. His smile stuck in my head because I've seen so many scared children in the clinic, and he was full of life and helping his father. This morning I found out he is gone. They bombed his house while the family was sleeping, and he was killed along with other members of his family. This is the reality we are living with. You expect death at any minute, any second, no matter where you are. Sometimes when I look at people, we look at each other as if it's the last time we may see one another. Unquote. Again, Dr. Mona Elfara, based in Gaza City. Many of the 1,100 Gazan dead were killed in their sleep, such as Mohammed Amar, when their buildings were obliterated by massive bombs. Can you imagine going to sleep, realizing it may be your last sleep? As I said, I don't want to dwell on statistics, but to grasp the scale of the death and destruction, I did something which I think is worth relaying to you. If you say 1,100 Gazans are dead, 1.8 million people live in this tiny enclave, 139 square miles. 1,100 out of 1.8 million. If this happened in the United States, we have 315 million people that live here. If this death happened on this scale in the United States, we'd be talking about almost 200,000 Americans dead in about 20 days. Actually, turns out to be 193,000. 20% are children, many of them under 5 years old. That would equate to 39,000 children dead in the United States. This is the scale of horror that is happening in Gaza. More like 360 kids in Gaza are dead, which equates, as I say, to 39,000 Americans. About 40 Israeli soldiers have been killed, all of them since the ground invasion. 3 civilians have been killed from Hamas rockets in Israel, and one of them a worker from Thailand. What I'd like to do is read to you an opinion piece that is posted at the Tangents website in the far right-hand column, tangents.com. It's written by Gabor Maté, who is a doctor. She is a Vancouver-based author, speaker, and she is a Holocaust survivor. This appeared in the Toronto Star on July 22nd. I'm quoting her exactly. As a Jewish youngster growing up in Budapest, an infant survivor of the Nazi genocide, I was for years haunted by a question resounding in my brain with such force that sometimes my head would spin. How was it possible? How could the world have let such horrors happen? It was a naive question, that of a child. I know better now. Such is reality. Whether in Vietnam or Rwanda or Syria, humanity stands by either complicitly or unconsciously or helplessly, as it always does. In Gaza today, we find ways of justifying the bombing of hospitals, the annihilation of families at dinner, the killing of pre-adolescents playing soccer on a beach. In Israel-Palestine, the powerful party has succeeded in painting itself as the victim, while the ones being killed and maimed become the perpetrators. They don't care about life, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says, abetted by the Obamas and Harper's, Prime Minister Harper of Canada, of this world. We care about life, says Netanyahu. Netanyahu, you who with surgical precision slaughter innocents, the young and the old, you who have cruelly blockaded Gaza for years, starving it of necessities, you who deprive Palestinians of more and more of their land, their water, their crops, their trees, you care about life? The words of Gabor Maté, Holocaust survivor. She continues, there is no understanding Gaza out of context. Hamas rockets or unjustifiable terrorist attacks on civilians. And that context is the longest ongoing ethnic cleansing operation in the recent and present centuries, the ongoing attempt to destroy Palestinian nationhood. The Palestinians used tunnels? So did my heroes, the poorly armed fighters of the Warsaw Ghetto. Unlike Israel, Palestinians lack Apache helicopters, guided drones, jet fighters with bombs, laser-guided artillery. Out of impotent defiance, they fire inept rockets, causing terror for innocent Israelis, but rarely physical harm. With such a gross imbalance of power, there is no equivalence of culpability. Israel wants peace? Perhaps. But as the veteran Israeli journalist Gideon Levy has pointed out, it does not want a just peace. Occupation and creeping annexation, an inhumane blockade, the destruction of olive groves, the arbitrary imprisonment of thousands, torture, daily humiliation of civilians, house demolitions, these are not policies compatible with any desire for a just peace. In Tel Aviv, journalist Gideon Levy now moves around with a bodyguard, the price of speaking the truth. I have visited Gaza and the West Bank. I saw multi-generational Palestinian families weeping in hospitals around the bedsides of their wounded, at the graves of their dead. These are not people who do not care about life. They are like us, Canadians, Jews, like anyone. They celebrate life, family, work, education, food, peace, joy, and they are capable of hatred. They can harbor vengeance in their hearts just like we can. One could debate details, historical and current, back and forth. Since my days as a young Zionist and later as a member of Jews for a Just Peace, I have often done so. I used to believe that if people knew the facts, they would open to the truth. That, too, was naive. This issue is far too charged with emotion. As the spiritual teacher Eckhart Tolle, has pointed out, the accumulated mutual pain in the Middle East is so acute, a significant part of the population finds itself forced to act out in an endless cycle of perpetration and retribution. People's leaders have been misleaders, so that they are led, have been confused. In the words of the prophet Jeremiah, the voices of justice and sanity are not heeded. Netanyahu has his reasons. Prime Minister Harper, President Obama have theirs. And what shall we do, we ordinary people? I pray we can listen to our hearts. My heart tells me that, quote unquote, never again is not a tribal slogan, that the murder of my grandparents in Auschwitz does not justify the ongoing dispossession of Palestinians, that justice, truth, peace are not tribal prerogatives, that Israel's right to defend itself, unarguable in principle, does not validate mass killing. A few days ago, I met with one of my dearest friends, a comrade from Zionist days, and now professor emeritus at an Israeli university. We spoke of everything but the daily savagery depicted on our TV screens. We both feared the rancor that would arise. But I want to say to my friend, can we not be sad together at what that beautiful old dream of Jewish redemption has come to? Can we not grieve the death of innocence? I am sad these days. Can we not at least mourn together? Written by Gabor Maté, doctor, who is a Vancouver-based author, speaker, Holocaust survivor. This appeared in the Toronto Star on July 22nd. At tangents.com, where the Gaza Corner stories are always posted every week, in the far right-hand column, there's a photo of a Palestinian woman carrying her belongings past the rubble of houses destroyed by Israeli strikes in Beit Hanun. This is excerpted from the Guardian UK newspaper. I find that the coverage in Europe doesn't have the self-censorship and bias that the American mainstream media does. The Guardian UK, this is an excerpt. The headline says, a pause in the bombing by Israeli forces and the ruins of Gaza are laid bare. In the dangerous streets, and this is written by Peter Beaumont, who has done an extraordinary job on the ground in Gaza. This is July 26th. In the dangerous streets around the hospital in Beit Hanun, the buildings were, by and large, still standing on Friday afternoon. By Saturday morning, after a day of intense Israeli bombing and shell fire, the hospital in the northern town was standing in a sea of rubble, its walls pockmarked with gunfire and torn by shrapnel. The skyline, until so recently regular and neat, had been transformed into something torn and ragged. The tops of a pair of minarets had been blown off, and the graves, in a cemetery smashed to pieces. Houses, offices, apartment blocks, and shops were collapsed or collapsing. What happened here in Beit Hanun and in other neighborhoods of Gaza hardest hit by the Israeli assault will inevitably demand an explanation. Whether the extremity of violence unleashed in these residential areas in recent days was proportionate, or if the destruction amounts to a war crime. These are questions for the days ahead. On Saturday, however, in the midst of a 12-hour, which has now, by the way, been extended to 24 hours, humanitarian ceasefire, the concerns were more immediate ones as thousands of Palestinian residents flocked back to their ruined neighborhoods to see what remained. As they came on foot and in cars, they were accompanied by fire engines, bulldozers, and ambulances of the Red Crescent, whose crews by mid-afternoon had recovered 85 bodies, many of them partially decomposed, buried under the rubble of Gaza's most damaged neighborhoods. Officials said the death toll among Palestinians had passed 1,000. In some places visited by The Observer, which part of the Guardian UK, whole blocks had been flattened, dozens of buildings at a time reduced to a moonscape from which the smell of death at times wafted. My house," said another man, hitting his head with his hand. Nothing, it seems, had escaped the flying pieces of white-hot metal thrown out by the bombs, not electricity cables or cars left behind, not windows or doors. Near the hospital, a man leads a horse out of the ruins, a long streak of blood staining its hind quarters where it was struck by shrapnel. Elsewhere, we come across donkeys and cattle killed where they were left tied up in the street, scorched, stomachs swelling with gas. A group of men show us the home of the Shabbat family, seven of whom died when it was flattened by a bomb. It is hard to imagine that anyone who did not flee could have survived the attack, but a few did. We lived through a night of horror. The shelling was all around our house, says Hanan al-Zanin, standing with four of her children outside their home. Zohair Hamad is with his wife, Fati, next to a home that is little more than a few barely standing walls. The water pumping station next to them is also badly damaged. We left at the beginning of the war, says Zohair. It is the first time that we have managed to come back. Fati adds, we're staying in the UN school in Jabalia. We came to get clothes for the children, but there is nothing left. It is the phrase we hear throughout a long day. Nothing left. And it is true, whole areas that were once inhabited have been reduced to a landscape of earth and dust and broken shapes. Although in places there is evidence fighting has taken place, what is hard to comprehend is the Israeli justification for the scale of the destruction, save destruction for its own sake in pursuit of a policy of collective punishment. Ahead of probable international criticism over the scale of the destruction, some Israeli political figures were trying to deny the scale of the attacks was in any way disproportionate. And if Beit Hanun is largely destroyed, Shujaiya, an eastern neighborhood of Gaza that has been shelled and bombed for a week, is incomparably worse. In the midst of an area of rubble the size of two football pitches in the last of these areas, we meet three brothers standing on what was once the four-story building in which their families lived in four apartments. Next to them is a bomb crater measuring 10 meters across and 6 meters deep. Allah Helu, 35, a carpenter, points to what is no longer there. That was a two-story house, he says. There was three stories, and over there was four stories high. We came to see our house. We thought it might have been damaged by a shell, but there is nothing left of it. We spent 20 years making our place nice, says his older brother. We spent all of our money on our homes. If there is something worse than the scenes of destruction, it is what is visible in their faces. in the faces of the people in Beit Hanun and Shujaiya. A man is led away down one street in Shujaiya, staggering and blind with grief. He is held up by two others. Women sit in the dust, crying. We find 33-year-old Rifat Sukur sitting outside his gutted house, a stunned look on his face. It is like an earthquake hit this street, he says, an earthquake. Except that this was not an earthquake. This was the work of men. That is an article that appears right now in The Guardian UK by Peter Beaumont. And lastly, and then we'll play Palestinian music for the remainder of Tangents, you'll see at the tangents.com website a photograph underneath this Peter Beaumont article between this and the article I'm about to read. It's a photo of Palestinian mourners at the funeral of members of the Abu Jami family, 25 of whom were killed when Israel bombed their house in Khan Yunis on July 21st. What I'm about to read is titled No Ceasefire Without Justice for Gaza. No Ceasefire Without Justice for Gaza, subtitled We Will Not Return to a Living Death of Siege and Blockade, Say Gaza Civil Society Leaders. And this was published in the Electronic Intifada on July 22nd. And reading it, I start with, We will not return to a living death of siege and blockade. As academics, public figures, and activists, witnessing the intended genocide of 1.8 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, we call for a ceasefire with Israel, only if conditioned on an end to the blockade and the restoration of basic freedoms that have been denied to the people for more than 7 years. Our foremost concerns are not only the health and safety of the people in our communities, but also the quality of their lives, their ability to live free of fear of imprisonment without due process, to support their families through gainful employment, and to travel to visit their relatives and further their education. These are fundamental human aspirations that have been severely limited for the Palestinian people for more than 47 years, but that have been particularly deprived from residents of Gaza since 2007. We have been pushed beyond the limits of what a normal person can be expected to endure. Charges in the media and by politicians of various stripes that accuse Hamas of ordering Gazan citizens to resist evacuation orders and thus use them as human shields are untrue. With temporary shelters full and the indiscriminate Israeli shelling, there is literally no place that is safe in Gaza. Likewise, Hamas represented the sentiment of the vast majority of residents when it rejected the unilateral ceasefire proposed by Egypt and Israel without consulting anyone in Gaza. We share the broadly held public sentiment that it is unacceptable to merely return to the status quo, in which Israel strictly limits travel in and out of the Gaza Strip, controls the supplies that come in, parenthetically including a ban on most construction materials, and prohibits virtually all exports, thus crippling the economy and triggering one of the highest poverty and unemployment rates in the Arab world. To do so would mean a return to a living death. Unfortunately, past experience has shown that the Israeli government repeatedly reneges on promises for further negotiations as well as on its commitments to reform. Likewise, the international community has demonstrated no political will to enforce these pledges. Therefore, we call for a ceasefire only when negotiated conditions result in the following: freedom of movement of Palestinians in and out of the Gaza Strip, unlimited import and export of supplies and goods, including by land, sea, and air, unrestricted use of the Gaza seaport, monitoring and enforcement of these agreements by a body appointed by the United Nations with appropriate security measures. Each of these expectations is taken for granted by most countries, and it is time for the Palestinians of Gaza to be accorded the human rights they deserve. And then there is a list of signatures of civil leaders in Gaza. And these are academics and public figures and activists.